today on the front porch, a long career in poetry.
I don't think all good poems come out of struggle and anguish and pain and deprivation. I think you can lead a fairly orderly life and still be a poet.
Maxine Kuman is a poet and writer who lives happily on a farm in rural New Hampshire. Her first collection of poems came out in 1961. Her 13th came out 40 years later. The Long Marriage is her first collection since she was nearly killed in a fall from a horse-drawn carriage more than 5 years ago. Tonight, she talks about her life, her writing, her accident, and long recuperation in an interview recorded in November of 2001. I'm John Walters. Join me and Maxine Kuman on the front porch on NHPR. Forty years ago, Maxine Kuman published her first book, a collection of poetry called Halfway. Since then, there have been 12 more collections, as well as novels, short stories, essays, and at least 20 children's books. She's won a whole lot of prizes, including a Pulitzer, and she's a former poet laureate of New Hampshire. Her newest book of poems, The Long Marriage, is her first in 5 years and her first since a near-fatal accident in the summer of 1998. The Long Marriage has just been published by W.W. Norton. Maxine, welcome to the front porch.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'd like to start out with the title poem, The Long Marriage. Could you read it for us?
I could. I think before I read it, though, I should gloss that one German word that's in it. After this poem appeared in, I think it was the Georgia Review, I got a wonderful letter from Bernard Schultz, who's professor of comparative lit in the Netherlands, and he told me the derivation of this word. It, and I'm quoting him, refers to the rush in and out just before the city gates were closed in the walled towns of the principalities which dotted Germany until Napoleon put an end to the little states, the Kleinstaaterei. So that's the derivation of the word. And here's the poem. The Long Marriage. The sweet jazz of their college days spools over them where they lie on the dark lake of night, growing old unevenly. The sexual thrill of Pee-wee Russell's clarinet, Jack Teagarden's trombone, half syrup, half sobbing slide, Errol Garner's rusty hum-along over the ivories, and Glenn Miller's plane going down again before sleep repossesses them. Torschlusspanik. Of course the Germans have a word for it. The shutting of the door, the bowels terror that one will go before the other as the clattering horse hooves near.
Is this a poem about your own marriage?
Yes, of course.
You've been married for?
55 years. I think that qualifies as lengthy.
Well, there are two pictures side by side, the jazz of their college days and, I guess, the fear of a long marriage ending, or maybe more precisely, the fear that the other one will end first.
Exactly. And I think this is very common to partners in an ongoing marriage of any duration.
Why choose this as the title for the whole book?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I think thematically it seemed appropriate. Not that I've stopped writing poems, but I'm certainly not churning them out. Right now I'm in a long dry period, but I'm busy writing other things, working on a textbook and so on. And I guess what I'm saying is I rather doubt there will be another full collection of poems. I hope I'm wrong, but... If that's to be the case, this seemed the proper summation.
Is there a theme or maybe a direction to this book?
Well, the first section are poems mostly of address to apostrophes is the technical term, addressed to long dead writers. The very first poem is called Skinny Dipping with William Wordsworth, and the next one is Thinking of Gorky While Clearing a Trail. And they're kind of poems of homage to Gerard Manley Hopkins and Muriel Rukeyser and Marianne Moore and even Rilke. So that's the first section. And then there are a pretty goodly number of, I suppose we would have to call them political poems, really laments for world situations in different parts of the world.
Do you find yourself writing about different things these days than before?
No, not really. I'm still writing out of my own dailiness. I mean, you know, there's not a big jump from the early poem that students love and that gets anthologized a lot, the excrement poem, to a poem in this book called The Brown Mountain, which is what I call our manure pile. So I guess I'm still writing about the same things.
When you said this is probably the last collection, is it harder for you to write poetry these days, harder to write in general?
It's certainly not harder to write in general. It's just I'm not, you know, the muse doesn't strike me, and I can't really, I don't approve of trying to force poems at this point. That's fine. It's wonderful to write exercise poems, and I did a lot of those in my misspent youth. But at this point in my life, I only want to write necessary poems, poems that really ask to be written.
And these days, poems aren't asking.
Well, I think it's because I haven't had very much contemplative time. I'm on the road a lot for PoBiz, and I'm working on a textbook that two other editors and I are putting together, a kind of tongue-in-cheek textbook that's going to be called Lofty Dogmas, Poets on Poetics. And it's a fairly complex book. So a lot of my energy has gone toward that.
You mentioned PoBiz, which is your term for
right.
the poetry business.
Right.
What's involved in the business of being a poet?
A lot of travel, and that's the hard part. But this is pretty much my livelihood. It's also pretty much my evangelical fervor for poetry.
Trying to get people to take a look at poetry?
Yeah, trying to spread out the tentacles of poetry ever farther and deeper. The best thing that happens is to go to a small college where students have been required to come to the reading. And to have some kids come up to me afterwards and say, wow, I've never been to a poetry reading before. I was sure I wouldn't understand a word of it. And I loved it. And now I'm going to go to another poetry reading. And so then I feel, you know, I feel like sort of a fundamentalist preacher who has saved a born-again Christian.
This is The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters with poet Maxine Kumin. Her new collection, The Long Marriage, is just out from W.W. Norton. If people get that much out of poetry when they finally are exposed to it, why do so many people not read it or experience it?
Well, I think it's partly, I think it's in the culture. If you look just look at any television sitcom and see how the poet is portrayed. He's a foppish creature wearing a floppy tie or scarf. He's absent-minded. He's just out of it. And this is the sort of the public portrait of the poet, which is too bad. It's very unfortunate. And I think also that a lot of kids get turned off of poetry by terrified teachers who don't understand the material and are scared to have a personal opinion. I mean, everybody acts shocked when I say, you don't have to like every poem you read. You don't have to study every poem that turns up. If you give it three honest tries and you still don't like it or it's still opaque to you, then turn the page.
In the book you wrote about your accident and your rehab, you wrote about how you had memorized poems, and you have always told your students to memorize poems for the time when you're taken prisoner. And you
right. when you're taken political prisoner is the expression I use. And then I look out at these shocked faces while they all hurriedly try to decide what they care enough about to go to jail for.
What is it about poetry that if you take the time to memorize some poems, that you can then feed off of them later
right.
on?
Well, I think you internalize the rhythms without trying to scan the lines. You sort of absorb them and you get the meter and you get the melody of the poem. You absorb the poem by osmosis, as it were. And when I was recovering from this terrible accident, and I was just starting to walk again because I was quadriplegic after the accident, I took A Shropshire Lad, which is A. Houseman's little pastoral poems, and they were favorites of my late adolescence. And I walked up to our carriage driving ring, which is about the size of a football field, and it was a little book. It fit in my hand like a breviary, and I re-memorized the poems that I had once had by heart, but, you know, I had dropped stanzas and lines and so on. And it really kept my mind off the terrible ordeal of walking, you know, walking a mile and then later a mile and a half and so on. I'm very happy that I still have those poems and lots of others.
Is there a poem that you particularly pulled out of your memory bank that maybe you could pull out right now?
Oh, John, now you're putting me on the spot. What if I goof? I can try. I could do a little Houseman thing. And remember, this is very melancholy and sentimental, as all his poems were. Everybody is always dying young and unfulfilled. With rue my heart is laden for golden friends I had, for many a rose-cheeked maiden and many a light-foot lad. By brooks too broad for leaping, the light-foot lads are laid. The rose-lipped girls are sleeping in fields where daisies played.
Did melancholy fit your mood when you were undergoing this long rehab?
Oh, I'm sure, but melancholy fit my mood even better when I was an adolescent.
Well, you had a very long and difficult rehab. For those who don't know, you were severely injured in the summer of 1998 when you were riding in a horse-drawn carriage. And
I was driving my favorite horse, and I had driven him literally 1,000 miles before this happened. It was just a freak accident.
Mm-hmm. And you were thrown from the carriage.
Right. And then he bolted, and then he turned at the bottom of the field and swerved to avoid me but pulled the carriage across my body. It's a 350-pound metal carriage, so that's why a lot of the damage is on my right side.
And at first, they thought you wouldn't survive. When you survived, they thought you would be a quadriplegic.
Right.
And you beat the odds, basically.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did beat the odds.
The Long Marriage is your first collection since the accident.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a time when you thought that you wouldn't write anymore after the accident?
Oh, I don't think so, John. I think writing is so intrinsically a part of me that it's more likely that I thought even if I had no use of my hands and feet, I would still figure out some way to write.
There are several poems in the collection that are out of your experience in rehab. I'd like to have you read one of them. This is a poem called The Woman Who Moans, which is, I take it, about one of your fellow rehab.
Yes, this is someone I observed. I spent hours and hours in the rehab gym each day as I had to relearn everything, how to walk, how to feed myself, etc. And this was a very unfortunate woman. I understand she was a school teacher. I never found out much more than that. So this is simply observation. It's called The Woman Who Moans, and the title goes right into the poem. The woman who moans is not in pain. She is making the sounds of speech. She drums her heels, a child strapped against her will in the stroller. Perhaps she protests. Perhaps she agrees in full with the therapists when they wheel her chair to the standing table and fasten her legs to supports that brace her upright. See how she clings to the tabletop. Whether she begs or resists release is hard to tell from the song she sings, moans that ascend to a blackbird's warble. Eventually, restrained like a pup on a leash, she will learn once again to walk. One on each side, they will hold her up by her voyaging belt, but the sounds she emits will not change. The fault line in her brain will continue to gape, and the bus, the 42nd Street bus that caught her mid-step and hurled her aloft, will go on transporting the rest of us.
We'll have more with Maxine Kumin in a moment. I'm John Walters on the front porch on NHPR. Mm-hmm. Next time on The Front Porch, Steve Curwood, New Hampshire resident and host of NPR's Living on Earth. That's tomorrow on The Front Porch.
Support for The Front Porch comes from our contributing listeners and from Franklin Pierce College, providing graduate and undergraduate programs for working adults with 6 campuses throughout New Hampshire. Information at 800-325-1090. And the Balsams Wilderness, a New Hampshire destination ski resort offering learn-to-ski workshops online at thebalsams.com. Stay with us for more of The Front Porch, and at 7 o'clock, it's Fresh Air.
This is The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters with Maxine Kuman, poet, writer. Her newest poetry collection, The Long Marriage, is just out from W.W. Norton. About 40 years ago, you wrote a poem called Grace.
Yes, I did.
Which I copied off a website, and I'd like to have you read that.
I'm delighted to see this poem again because it's one of the poems that we had to leave out of the selected poems. My editor at Norton and I struggled long and hard about what to include and what to cut out. And I've been so prolific that there are an awful lot of poems I still like that have reverted. The copyright has reverted to me, and this is one of them. And now there is a plan underfoot to bring out a whole collection of these remaindered, as I think we're going to call them, reclaimings, early non-selected poems. And this is one I like because it's in quite a tight form. It's called Grace. Hens have their gravel. Gravel sticks the way it should stick in the craw, and stone on stone is tooth for grinding raw. And grinding raw I learn from this to fill my crop the way I should. I put down pudding stone and find it good. I find it good to line my gut with tidy octagons of grit. No loophole and no chink make vents in it. And in it vents no slime or sludge, no losses sluice, no terrors slough. God give me appetite for stone enough. The fun of this poem, of course, is how the one stanza wraps itself into the next, those little repeats. And that's always the challenge of writing in form.
I guess the question I had reading it was, do you have stone enough now?
Well, I must have had stone enough to get through what I got through, I would guess.
For those of us who aren't farm boys or farm girls, maybe you could explain what place the grit plays in the
digestive tract of poultry.
Yes.
Well, they don't have teeth to chew, so what they swallow is digested in the crop, is sort of a primitive first stomach. And that's why you see hens picking around the gravel and grit of the barnyard. They have to swallow enough grit to help digest whatever it is they eat.
So how do you relate that to your own experience of life and the struggles
of
life?
Well, this is such an early poem. It seems incredible to me. I was young then, and I was projecting, I guess. But I do relate it to being strong enough to put up with whatever comes your way.
Is that just in terms of life, or is that in terms of needing a certain amount of struggle to be a writer?
I don't really hold with that theory. That was Henry David Thoreau advising the East India merchant who said he was going to go out to Asia and make his living selling, God knows what, coconuts or cotton or spices. And then when he came back, he was going to become a poet. And Thoreau said to him with a touch of Yankee asperity, he should have gone up attic at once. He should have been a starving artist from the very beginning if he wanted to be a poet. Well, I don't really believe that that's necessary. I don't think that you have to. I don't think all good poems come out of struggle and anguish and pain and deprivation. I think you can lead a fairly orderly life and still be a poet.
What has living on a farm done for you as a person and as a writer?
It's been immensely gratifying. I really hate cities. I'm claustrophobic every time I go into one. I'm a real chicken about walking around in big cities. It just feels terribly anonymous and unsafe to me. I'm happiest in the woods. I'm very comfortable in my life on the farm. I feel immensely fulfilled. I like the physical labor. And, of course, I love my critters.
When did you write your first poem?
When I was about 8, I think.
Like many of us.
Yes, I think it starts early.
When did you realize that you were a poet? Or is that too grand a term for it?
Well, I always wrote poetry. I stopped writing poetry when I was 17 and a freshman in college, and I received an adverse comment from a young instructor. Now looking back, I see that I was 17 and he was 23. But I didn't write again for about 7 or 8 years, and then I wrote in the closet. And then I started writing light verse for the Slicks. That seemed safe enough, a little tightly rhymed, you know, couplets and quatrains and so on. And then finally I got to go to a poetry workshop at the Boston Center for Adult Education, where I met John Holmes, who was a professor at Tufts and a poet himself, and who got me my first job teaching freshman comp at Tufts University in 1957 or 8. But because I was a woman, I was only allowed to teach freshman comp to the phys ed majors and the dental technicians, for fear that I wasn't good enough to teach, you know, academic students.
The serious students.
Right. Precisely.
That comment from that young teacher that sort of put you off writing for several years, do you think that kind of thing happens to a lot of people?
Well, it doesn't happen to anybody that I encounter, because I'm terribly conscious of how vulnerable you are when you're 17 or 18 or even 20. And I make sure not to make that negative a comment. I think in a way he did me a favor, because it saved me many years of writing terrible romantic sonnets.
Sort of a derivative A.E. Houseman.
More derivative Edna St. Vincent Millay, I think.
So you had to, you had to get away from it for a while and sort of find your own voice?
Mm-hmm, I did, yes.
How do you write poetry?
Well, everybody has a different style. I like to write on my old IBM Selectric, the first draft, and I like just to let everything that will come on that subject, no matter how discursive, get it out on a first draft. And then I like to turn it over and let it come back to room temperature for a day. And then I like to run it back through the typewriter, incorporating whatever changes I've made in longhand or additions that I've made in longhand. And I repeat that process until the poem sort of takes shape and I can see whether what exactly it wants to be or what direction it's going in. So I worry a little about working on the computer, first off, because I think students tend to revise as they go. They don't stop to copy. They don't stop to print out. And so you lose a lot of that early impetus for the poem. But that's, you know, that's my own curmudgeonly way. It's not in any sense to be taken as the one correct route.
You also write a lot of prose.
I do.
Is the process different?
Not really. I don't see a wall between the genres. I think that, for one thing, it's good for poets to write prose, because it forces you to write a simple declarative sentence with a noun and a verb and an object. And now with the new fragmentary language poetry, there's no obligation toward grammar or punctuation, and you just can sprinkle things on the page. You can hear my hostility to language poetry shining brightly through. But I do think it's a good discipline for poets to work in prose. And I like writing prose.
It's your inner curmudgeon shining through again.
Yes, ever.
You've written quite a few children's books. Donald Hall does that too.
Yes.
Is there an affinity between poetry and children's books? And the thing that came to my mind was that in both genres, every word counts.
That's true, but I think, at least for me, the children's books came as responses to my own children. I mean, I wrote my first children's book for my son, who was the youngest in his family, and it's about Sebastian and the dragon. It's the littlest dragon, and Sebastian is the youngest, and so on. And my kids were my collaborators, in a way, because it was, you have to listen to this story now, or there'll be no dessert. And they'll be very quick to tell you this.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you if there was a poem from your new book that you'd particularly like to read.
This is a little bit light, but it's so New Hampshire that I'd really like to read it. This is not a typical poem of mine, but I enjoy it. It's called John Green Takes His Warner, New Hampshire Neighbor to a Red Sox Game. Everett down the hills, 52 and trim, no beer gut, raises beef, corn, hay, cuts cordwood between harvests, goes to bed at 8 and falls into sleep like a parachutist. He's never been to a ball game. He's never been to Boston, though he went over to Portland, Maine one time 10-15 years ago. In Sullivan Square, they luck out, find a space for John's car, take the T to Fenway Park, the famous T, a kind of underground trolley, runs in the dark. No motorman that Ev can see, jammed with other sports fans. John has to show him how to put the token in, how to press with his hips to go through the turnstile, how to stand back while the doors whoosh shut, how to grab a strap as the car pitches forward, how to push out with the surging crowd. Afterward, Ev says the game's a whole lot better on TV. Too many fans, too many other folks for him.
Everett's one of those natural New Hampshire poet types. Do you have neighbors like Everett?
Not so much anymore, but we certainly did 30, 40 years ago.
And I guess you've also become something of a Red Sox fan in your old age,
yes.
Which is,
well,
more grit for the craw.
Yeah, that phenomenon of my Red Sox affiliation took place while I was in rehab, and my son hooked up whatever it is, Nesson, I guess, so that I could watch the games. And that was really the one thing I had to look forward to all day, was that there would be a Red Sox game that night. And I really began to feel that I was part of that family of Nomar and then Mo and Jerry Remy and Sean McDonough, the announcers. And those voices became so familiar and soothing to me that I can remember feeling really a terrible lump in my throat when the game was over each night. But I'm really into it, I tell you. I'm ready for next season.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me, John. It was a pleasure.
Poet, writer, and farmer Maxine Kuman. Her new collection of poems is called The Long Marriage. It's just out from W.W. Norton. Next time on The Front Porch, Steve Curwood, host and creator of NPR's weekly environmental program, Living on Earth. Steve lives in southeast New Hampshire. He'll talk about his career in print and radio, how he got interested in environmental journalism, and how he created Living on Earth. Steve Curwood on The Front Porch tomorrow. The Front Porch is a production of NHPR. Producer Shay Zeller, executive producer Laura Colbert. I'm John Walters. Join me on The Front Porch tomorrow at 6:30 on NHPR.
At NHPR, we get support from our contributing listeners and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, honoring New Hampshire's Superintendent of the Year, Dr. Philip McCormick of the Keene School District, SAU 29, and the Irwin Zone in Laconia. Irwin is home for Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, and Toyota in central New Hampshire, online at irwinzone.com. I'm Roger Parmley. Stay with us. Fresh Air is coming up in just a few seconds at 7 o'clock. This is NHPR, news and information for the Granite State. WEBO 89.1 Concord in Manchester, 90.3 in Nashua, 104.3 in Dover, 91.3 Littleton. WEVH 91.3 Hanover in the Upper Valley, WEVN 90.7 Keene and the Monadnock region, WEVC 107.1 Gorham and the North Country, and WEVJ 99.5 Jackson and the Mount Washington Valley.